Chapter 27. Forgive her, said Lingard. Her fears are for me. Dot, tease about your going? Mrs. Travers interrupted, swiftly. Yes, it is, and you must forgive her. He had turned away his eyes with something that resembled embarrassment, but suddenly he was assailed by an irresistible longing to look again at that woman. At the moment of parting he clung to her with his glance as a man holds with his hands a priceless and disputed possession. The faint blush that overspread gradually Mrs. Travers' features gave her face an air of extraordinary and startling animation. The danger you run? She asked, eagerly. He repelled the suggestion by a sliding gesture of the hand. Nothing worth looking at twice. Don't give it a thought, he said. I've been in tighter places. He clapped his hands and waited till he heard the cabin door open behind his back. S. Steward, my pistols. The mulatto in slippers, apron to the chin, glided through the cabin with unseeing eyes, as though for him no one there had existed. Is it my heart that aches so? Mrs. Travers asked herself, contemplating Lingard's motionless figure. How long will this sensation of dull pain last? Will it last forever? How many changes of clothes shall I put up, sir? Asked the steward, while Lingard took the pistols from him, and eased the hammers after putting on fresh caps. We'll take nothing this time, steward. He received in turn from the mulatto's hands a red silk handkerchief, a pocketbook, a cigar case. He knotted the handkerchief loosely around his throat. It was evident he was going through the routine of every departure for the shore. He even opened the cigar case to see whether it had been filled. At, sir, murmured the half-caste. Lingard flung it on his head. Take your orders from this lady, steward, till I come back. The cabin is hers, do you hear? He sighed ready to go, and seemed unable to lift a foot. I'm coming with you, declared Mrs. Travers suddenly in a tone of unalterable decision. He did not look at her. He did not even look up. He said nothing, till after Carter had cried, "Colin, you can't, Mrs. Travers." When without budging he whispered to himself, "Of course." Mrs. Travers had pulled already the hood of her cloak over her head and her face within the dark cloth had turned an intense and unearthly white, in which the violet of her eyes appeared unfathomably mysterious. Carter started forward. "You don't know this man," he almost shouted. "I do know him," she said, and before the reproachfully unbelieving attitude of the other she added, speaking slowly and with emphasis, "Colin, there is not, I verily believe, a single thought or act of his life, that I don't know." "'Tis true, it's true," muttered Lingard to himself. Carter threw up his arms with a groan. "Stand back," said a voice, that sounded to him like a growl of thunder, and he felt a grip on his hand which seemed to crush every bone. He jerked it away. "Mrs. Travers! Stay," he cried. They had vanished through the open door, and the sound of their footsteps had already died away. Carter turned about bewildered, as if looking for help. "Who is he, steward? Who in the name of all the mad devils is he?" he asked, wildly. He was confounded by the cold and philosophical tone of the answer. "'Tain't my place to trouble about that, sir, nor yours, I guess. S'n'T," shouted Carter. "Why, he has carried the lady off." The steward was looking critically at the lamp, and after a while screwed the light down. "That's better," he mumbled. "Good God! What is a fellow to do?" continued Carter, looking at Assam and Amada who were whispering together, and gave him only an absent glance. He rushed on deck, and was struck blind instantly by the night that seemed to have been lying in wait for him. He stumbled over something soft, kicked something hard, flung himself on the rail. "See, come back," he cried. "Come back, Captain, Mrs. Travers, or let me come to." He listened. The breeze blew cool against his cheek. A black bandage seemed to lie over his eyes. "Gee gone," he groaned, utterly crushed. And suddenly he heard Mrs. Travers' voice remote in the depths of the night. "Effin' the brig," it said, and these words, pronouncing themselves in the immensity of a lightless universe, thrilled every fiber of his body by the commanding sadness of their tone. Defend! Defend the brig! Dot, I am damned if I do, shouted Carter in despair. You unless you come back. ... Mrs. Travers. ... As though I were on board myself, went on the rising cadence of the voice, more distant now, a marvel of faint and imperious clearness. Carter shouted no more. He tried to make out the boat for a time, and when, giving it up, he leaped down from the rail, the heavy obscurity of the brig's main deck was agitated like a somber pool by his jump, swayed, eddied, seemed to break up. Blotches of darkness recoiled, drifted away, bare feet shuffled hastily, confused murmurs died out. El Lascars, he muttered, the crew is all agog. Afterward he listened for a moment to the faintly tumultuous snores of the white men sleeping in rows, with their heads under the break of the poop. Somewhere about his feet, the yacht's black dog, invisible, and chained to a deck ring bolt, whined, rattled the thin links, pattered with his claws in his distress at the unfamiliar surroundings, begging for the charity of human notice. Carter stooped impulsively, and was met by a startling lick in the face. Allo, boy. He thumped the thick curly sides, stroked the smooth-headed boy, Rover. Down. Lie down, dog. You don't know what to make of it, do you, boy? The dog became still as death. Well, neither do I, muttered Carter. But such natures are helped by a cheerful contempt for the intricate and endless suggestions of thought. He told himself that he would soon see what was to come of it, and dismissed all speculation. Had he been a little older he would have felt that the situation was beyond his grasp, but he was too young to see it whole, and in a manner detached from himself. All these inexplicable events filled him with deep concern, but then on the other hand he had the key of the magazine and he could not find it in his heart to dislike Lingard. He was positive about this at last, and to know that much after the discomfort of an inward conflict went a long way toward a solution. When he followed Shaw into the cabin he could not repress a sense of enjoyment, or hide a faint and malicious smile. Gone away did you say? And carried off the lady with him, discoursed Shaw very loud in the doorway. Did he? Well, I am not surprised. What can you expect from a man like that, who leaves his ship in an open roadstead without I won't say orders, but without as much as a single word to his next in command? And at night at that. That just shows you the kind of man. Is this the way, to treat a chief mate? I apprehend he was riled at the little altercation we had just before you came on board. I told him a truth or two but never mind. There's the law, and that's enough for me. I am captain, as long as he is out of the ship, and if his address before very long is not in one of Her Majesty's jails or other I.O.S.O., rise you to call me a Dutchman. You mark my words. He walked in masterfully, sat down and surveyed the cabin in a leisurely and autocratic manner, but suddenly his eyes became stony with amazement and indignation. He pointed a fat and trembling forefinger. Niggers, he said, huskily. I in the cuddy. In the cuddy. He appeared bereft of speech for a time. Since he entered the cabin Assam had been watching him in thoughtful and expectant silence. I can't have it, he continued with genuine feeling in his voice. Damn. I've too much respect for myself. He rose with heavy deliberation. His eyes bulged out in a severe and dignified stare. Oh, out you go! He bellowed, suddenly, making a step forward. Reed Scott! What are you up to, mister? Asked in a tone of dispassionate surprise the steward whose head appeared in the doorway. These are the captain's friends. Show me a man's friends and... Dot began Shaw, dogmatically, but abruptly passed into the tone of admonition. Why you take your mug out of the way, bottle washer? They ain't friends of mine. I ain't a vagabond. I know what's due to myself. Quit. He hissed, fiercely. Assam, with an alert movement, grasped the handle of his kris. Shaw puffed out his cheeks and frowned. Look out! He will stick you like a prize pig, murmured Carter without moving a muscle. Shaw looked around helplessly. Andy, you would enjoy the fun, wouldn't you? He said with slow bitterness. Carter's distant non-committal smile quite overwhelmed him by its horrid frigidity. Extreme despondency replaced the proper feeling of racial pride in the primitive soul of the mate. Oh my God! What luck! What have I done to fall amongst that lot? He groaned, sat down, and took his big gray head in his hands. Carter drew aside to make room for Amada, who, in obedience to a whisper from her brother, sought to leave the cabin. She passed out after an instant of hesitation, during which she looked up at Carter once. Her brother, motionless in a defensive attitude, protected her retreat. She disappeared. Hassam's grip on his weapon relaxed. He looked in turn at every object in the cabin, as if to fix its position in his mind forever, and following his sister, walked out with noiseless footfalls. They entered the same darkness which had received, enveloped, and hidden the troubled souls of Lingard and Edith, but to these two the light from which they had felt themselves driven away was now like the light of forbidden hopes. It had the awful and tranquil brightness that a light burning on the shore has for an exhausted swimmer about to give himself up to the fateful sea. They looked back. It had disappeared. Carter had shut the cabin door behind them to have it out with Shaw. He wanted to arrive at some kind of working compromise with the nominal commander, but the mate was so demoralized by the novelty of the assaults made upon his respectability that the young defender of the brig could get nothing from him except lamentations mingled with mild blasphemies. The brig slept, and along her quiet deck the voices raised in her cabin Shaw's appeals and reproaches directed vociferously to heaven, together with Carter's inflexible drawl mingled into one deadened, modulated, and continuous murmur. The lockouts in the waist, motionless and peering into obscurity, one ear turned to the sea, were aware of that strange resonance like the ghost of a quarrel that seemed to hover at their backs. Wasub, after seeing Hassam and Amada into their canoe, prowled to and fro the whole length of the vessel vigilantly. There was not a star in the sky, and no gleam on the water. There was no horizon, no outline, no shape for the eye to rest upon, nothing for the hand to grasp. An obscurity that seemed without limit in space and time had submerged the universe like a destroying flood. A lull of the breeze kept for a time the small boat in the neighborhood of the brig. The hoisted sail, invisible, fluttered faintly, mysteriously, and the boat rising and falling bodily to the passage of each invisible undulation of the water seemed to repose upon a living breast. Lingard, his hand on the tiller, sat up erect, expectant and silent. Mrs. Travers had drawn her cloak close around her body. Their glances plunged infinitely deep into a lightless void, and yet they were still so near the brig that the piteous whine of the dog, mingled with the angry rattling of the chain, reached their ears faintly, evoking obscure images of distress and fury. A sharp bark ending in a plaintive howl that seemed raised by the passage of phantoms invisible to men rent the black stillness, as though the instinct of the brute inspired by the soul of night had voiced in a lamentable plaint the fear of the future, the anguish of lurking death, the terror of shadows. Not far from the brig's boat, Hassam and Amada in their canoe, letting their paddles trail in the water, sat in a silent and invincible torpor, as if the fitful puffs of wind had carried to their hearts the breath of a subtle poison that, very soon, would make them die. Have you seen the white woman's eyes? Cried the girl. She struck her palms together loudly, and remained with her arms extended, with her hands clasped. Oh, Hassam! Have you seen her eyes shining under her eyebrows like rays of light darting under the arched boughs in a forest? They pierced me. I shuddered at the sound of her voice. I saw her walk behind him, and it seems to me that she does not live on earth, that all this is witchcraft. She lamented in the night. Hassam kept silent. He had no illusions, and in any other man, but Lingard he would have thought the proceeding no better than suicidal folly. for him, Travers and Delcasser were two powerful Rajas, probably relatives of the ruler of the land of the English whom he knew to be a woman. But why they should come and interfere with the recovery of his own kingdom was an obscure problem. He was concerned for Lingard's safety, that the risk was incurred mostly for his sake, so that the prospects of the great enterprise should not be ruined by a quarrel over the lives of these whites, did not strike him so much as may be imagined. There was that in him which made such an action on Lingard's part appear all but unavoidable. Was he not Raja Asim, and was not the other a man of strong heart, of strong arm, of proud courage, a man great enough to protect highborn princes a friend? Imada's words called out a smile which, like the words, was lost in the darkness. F forget your weariness, he said, gently, lest, O sister, we should arrive too late. The coming day would throw its light on some decisive event. Asim thought of his own men who guarded Yemma and he wished to be where they could hear his voice. He regretted Jaffer was not there. Asim was saddened by the absence from his side of that man who once had carried what he thought would be his last message to his friend. It had not been the last. He had lived to cherish new hopes, and to face new troubles, and, perchance, to frame another message yet, while death knocked with the hands of armed enemies at the gate. The breeze steadied. The succeeding swell swung the canoe smoothly up the unbroken ridges of water traveling apace along the land. They progressed slowly, but Amada's heart was more weary than her arms, and Asim, dipping the blade of his paddle without a splash, peered right and left, trying to make out the shadowy forms of islets. A long way ahead of the canoe and holding the same course, the brig's dinghy ran with broad lug extended, making for that narrow and winding passage between the coast and the southern shoals, which led to the mouth of the creek connecting the lagoon with the sea. Thus on that starless night the shallows were peopled by uneasy souls. The thick veil of clouds stretched over them, cut them off from the rest of the universe. At times Mrs. Travers had in the darkness the impression of dizzy speed, and again it seemed to her that the boat was standing still, that everything in the world was standing still, and only her fancy roamed free from all trammels. Lingard, perfectly motionless by her side, steered, shaping his course by the feel of the wind. Presently he perceived ahead a ghostly flicker of faint, livid light which the earth seemed to throw up against the uniform blackness of the sky. The dinghy was approaching the expanse of the shallows. The confused clamor of broken water deepened its note. "How long are we going to sail like this?" asked Mrs. Travers, gently. She did not recognize the voice that pronounced the word always in answer to her question. It had the impersonal ring of a voice without a master. Her heart beat fast. "Captain Lingard," she cried. "Yes." "What?" he said, nervously, as if startled out of a dream. "I asked you how long we were going to sail like this," she repeated, distinctly. "If the breeze holds, we shall be in the lagoon soon after daybreak. That will be the right time to. I shall leave you on board the hulk with Jorgensen." "And you? What will you do?" she asked. As he had to wait for a while. "I will do what I can," she heard him say at last. There was another pause. "All I can," he added. The breeze dropped, the sail fluttered. "I have perfect confidence in you," she said. "But are you certain of success?" "No." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.